It's Wednesday, May 12th, and a leader with no followers is just someone taking a walk. We start here. In its most dramatic leadership shuffle since Election Day, House Republicans prepare to demote one of their own.
Not because of some scandal or not because she did something wrong, but because she has consistently told the truth.
If her only sin was refusing to support a big lie, what's next for voting in America? An escalation in Israel is rapidly transforming into a crisis.
This time it went from virtually nothing to 150 rockets to 500 rockets.
Some areas are lit by the glow of rockets. Others are being snuffed out entirely by missiles. We'll take you there.
Bags over the gas pumps.
And we were told there was plenty of gas. So what happened?
When you tell a group of people not to worry, essentially the first thing they do is worry.
As states declare emergencies, it's not just the hackers causing a shortage, but the rest of us. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
Senate will come to order.
On the night of January 6th, in the hours after a siege on the American Capitol, millions of Americans were sitting at home, mouths agape, asking themselves, what just happened in our country?
Trump and I... We've had a hell of a journey.
And in those hours, the prevailing sentiment was that our democracy had bent, but it didn't break, that a fever had somehow broken.
All I can say is count me out. Enough is enough. I've tried to be helpful.
You saw this from several members of Congress, saying if a test of loyalty to President Trump was ignoring the will of voters, that to be in his corner, you've got to dispute the results of an election that had been affirmed again and again. That's just too much to ask of me.
We're going to have a lot of work we have to do. People have been lied to.
One of those members was Liz Cheney, the Republican congresswoman from Wyoming. And in the days since January 6th, she's been consistent. What horrified her then horrifies her now.
I will not sit back and watch in silence while others lead our party down a path that abandons the rule of law and joins the former president's crusade to undermine our democracy.
But for most other Republicans in Washington, that calculus has changed. The loyalty tests are back. And later today, Cheney's colleagues are expected to tell her, you don't speak for the rest of us any longer. Huge day for the GOP in Congress. Leaders about to gather on Capitol Hill to vote on their party's leadership. So let's start the day with ABC's chief Washington correspondent, Jonathan Carl. John, first question, this is done, right? Like they're going to go into a room and vote, but we know the result already? Cheney's gone?
Well, it sure looks that way, Brad. Here's what we know. The Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, has said that there will be a vote on recalling Liz Cheney from leadership. And it's a secret ballot. It's behind closed doors. It takes just a simple majority to remove her from leadership. And we know that McCarthy has said publicly that he intends to vote to remove her. We know that the number two Republican in leadership, Steve Scalise, has said the same. And a whole bunch of other, you know, Trump loyalists in the Republican conference, a conference that is dominated by Trump loyalists, have been saying that Cheney has to go. And we also know that the former president himself is saying that he has endorsed Lee Stefanik, congresswoman from New York, to replace Cheney. And so, by the way, have McCarthy and Scalise.
And yet now we've heard from enough skeptical conservatives that are like, we don't want Cheney there, but we don't know about Stefanik, that they've actually pushed back the vote to determine who would replace Cheney. So they might just vote to remove her with no clear idea of who actually takes her spot. I just don't get it, John. I thought Liz Cheney already faced a leadership challenge right after she voted for impeachment. So what happened in the last 3 months that did put her underwater?
She did. Isn't it amazing, Brad? She did survive a leadership challenge. I mean, the fact that this is the second leadership challenge in just a few months is amazing.
Congresswoman Liz Cheney, the third highest Republican in the House, gave her colleagues cover, unequivocally backing impeachment in advance, saying there has never been a greater betrayal by a president of the United States.
What happened is after she voted to impeach Donald Trump, there was a big movement to get her removed.
What I saw in Wyoming today were hundreds of patriots who came out to denounce the leadership of Liz Cheney.
Some of Trump's most loyal supporters in the House started gathering a petition demanding a vote. McCarthy granted a vote.
Liz Cheney to remain as conference chair or no?
Yes.
At that point, though, Kevin McCarthy said that he was standing by Liz Cheney. What has changed?
We must speak the truth. Our election was not stolen, and America has not failed.
Is that Liz Cheney has continued to be consistent.
Do you believe President Trump should be speaking, or former President Trump should be speaking at CPAC this weekend?
Yes, he should.
Congresswoman Cheney?
That's up to CPAC. I've been clear my views about President Trump.
That Donald Trump had lied and lied repeatedly about the election.
I don't believe that he should be playing a role in the future of the party.
The future of the Republican Party needed to be a non-Trump future.
On that high note, thank you all very much.
And Kevin McCarthy, among others, has said that that's not unity, that, we have to stop talking about such divisive matters, that we're going into a midterm where we need Donald Trump's support.
GOP Representative Liz Cheney is getting slammed by some conservatives when she gave President Biden a fist bump Wednesday night.
And she has, quite frankly, infuriated the likes of not just Trump, but McCarthy and other Trump supporters in Congress.
Well, and so this is one person we're talking about, right? Like Liz Cheney. How many Americans know who the number three member of the Republican House conference is? Like, not many. But does this signify something larger to you? How significant is this moment for the future of the GOP?
I think it's an incredibly important moment in our political life and for the future of the Republican Party. Liz Cheney is somebody, obviously the daughter of Vice President Dick Cheney, somebody who was a real rising star in Congress, very conservative, somebody who many thought of as a future Speaker of the House. And to see her tossed aside, not because of some scandal or not because she did something wrong, but because she has consistently told the truth.
The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters. He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding. These facts require immediate action by President Trump.
We all thought after, I mean, I did anyway, Brad, that after January 6th, after seeing what Trump had done.
And it pains me to say this because I had considered Kevin McCarthy a great friend.
There was a sense that the Republican Party was now going to move in a new direction. He lost the election by 7 million votes. More than 7 million votes in terms of the popular right. vote, there was a sense that the Republican Party would now have to try to define a post-Trump future.
But 2 weeks after January 6th, he goes down to Mar-a-Lago, and it was almost like January 6th never happened. You know, we wink and nod at the BLM. Maybe it was Antifa. It's not really our fault. Let's just move on. Gosh, that was a whole 4 months ago. Let's just move on.
What this vote shows is that at least for now, there is no post-Trump future for the Republican Party.
But doesn't that mean that, like, Trump's whole argument at this point was, you should follow me because I won, because all these state elections were wrong. Like, that's what it would take to convince yourself that President Trump was a winning candidate here, that he's worth following again and again and again. So going forward, like, does this mean part of being a Republican means you have to believe that election was stolen, therefore you have to believe that voter fraud is pervasive, therefore to be a Republican, you have to change election laws and election practices in this country. Like that is a unifying platform of the GOP at this point.
Hi, Governor Doug Ducey here. Today, I'm signing SB 1485.
That's what's happened. That's what we see in state after state with these efforts to tighten voter restrictions.
If an individual is signed up to automatically be mailed an early ballot and then stops voting entirely for a full 4 years, their county recorder will ask them if they still want to automatically be mailed a ballot.
To basically put roadblocks in the path of voting in the name of fighting a fraud that didn't exist. It's really an astounding development. One of the things that I'm still trying to get my head around and trying to understand where the Republicans are going on this is this election, this 2020 election that Trump lost and lost so decisively, was an election that for most other Republicans was actually quite good. I mean, Republicans picked up seats in the House where they were not expected to pick up seats.
Can the party at this point successfully win back the House or even the Senate without Trump?
No.
So how are you claiming that this election was filled with fraud and, you know, and stolen votes and all of this, when in fact, in district after district around the country, Republicans were winning?
Right. And remember, you know, we hear about the laws making it harder to vote. There's also increasingly laws being passed about who even has oversight, who really controls the count in the first place. And it begs the question, if the reason that the Electoral College did hold up, if the reason democracy held firm was because lawmakers in state capitals, red, blue, everyone, affirmed their rightfully tallied votes, would that play out the same way today, 6 months later, based on the rhetoric within each party? Jonathan Carl in Washington. Thanks so much.
You've got it, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, when you talk to someone who's watched Middle Eastern violence up close, the three words you never want to hear, this feels different. Our team is on the ground. Next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
Now, if the question for the minority party in Washington is, who's leading us? The question for the majority is, how do we want to lead? There are already enough complex issues to deal with without a crisis in the Middle East.
It's the worst violence between Hamas and Israel we've seen in years.
The rocket attacks are continuing, and there are fears that the violence will escalate further.
Well, that is what has developed in just the span of 48 hours. And with rockets in the air, with lives on the line, the U.S. is being asked, where do you stand? ABC's chief national correspondent Matt Gutman has hustled to Tel Aviv in Israel. Matt, I mean, when we checked in with Jordana Miller yesterday, she was talking about 150 rockets fired in the span of hours. Like, where are we now?
About 500 rockets later, Brad. That was in a span of hours yesterday evening. And I was here for a lot of it on the balcony, just listening to the booms. That's the Iron Dome intercepting a lot of these rockets, but not all of them. The code red sirens rang out. People scrambling for shelter in the streets, literally so you could see them running into supermarkets or ducking into alleys, anywhere where they could get a little bit of shelter. And I guess one of the things that is so jarring about these rocket attacks is that you have no idea where they're going. They're just blitzed out of Gaza. The chances are you're not going to be hit, but literally millions of people heard those sirens and heard the booms. Some of those rockets landing and killing multiple people and wounding several dozen.
And so why was, like, we've seen rockets fired out of Gaza into Israel. Like, that happens all the time. It sounds like the difference here is where they are going.
The escalation happened really fast this time. You know, typically it's a dribble. Hamas will launch a few rockets. Israel will retaliate with a couple of airstrikes, and it might progress from there. This time it went from virtually nothing to 150 rockets to 500 rockets. Many of them made it through, striking really the guts of Israel, the heart of central Israel.
What we have done, on the other hand, is to target militants and terrorists inside the Gaza Strip, and we have done so during the night. We're doing it as we speak.
Israel says it targeted 500 Hamas and Islamic Jihad targets inside the Gaza Strip. We're talking about massive airstrikes, significant rocket attacks.
Gaza health officials reporting at least 24 Palestinians are dead, including several children.
But it's not only that.
Tensions have been escalating over Israeli moves to evict Palestinian families from their homes in East Jerusalem.
In Israeli towns, inside Israel proper, these mixed Jewish-Arab towns, there was essentially an uprising.
Israeli police stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque using tear gas and rubber bullets.
200 Palestinians with Israeli citizenship were reportedly wounded in these protests.
There is escalation. Somebody is responsible for this escalation. His name is Benjamin Netanyahu.
So that is happening simultaneously. So what you have is violence in Gaza, violence in Jerusalem, as we've seen over the past several days, but also violence peppered throughout all these different places in Israel proper. And that's what makes it feel different from any time in really a generation. It's the confluence of all of these different factors happening simultaneously.
Hey, what do you do if you're the Biden administration? Because I think it's natural to hear about like the scene you just described of rockets just bursting in the air above your head, hearing that people are dying, and to go, oh, that's horrible. Hope everyone's okay. And yet, I think there's a lot of people who would say that actually doesn't begin to cover what Israel has done to Palestinians. So, I mean, if you're the Biden administration here, how do you walk that line in your response?
It's a really impossible line to walk, and it's one that administrations have been trying to toe for 70 years.
We stand by Israel's right to defend itself. We also stand by the principle that Palestinians deserve the right to live in safety and security.
So they're basically saying, everybody's got some merit to this. Can't you all just get along? And the answer to that, we know, is, well, no, they can't. Certainly not right now.
We are urging this message of de-escalation. To see this loss of life come to an end.
And as the Israeli defense minister said, this is going to be a long campaign. It's going to get worse, they said, before it gets better. One more thing we haven't seen in a while, Israeli calling up reservists, thousands of them. The airspace in Israel last night was shut down for multiple hours. This definitely feels a little bit different than in years past.
Yeah, a lot more heightened. All right, Matt Gutman, stay safe. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
When a group of hackers forced one of the country's largest gas pipelines to shut down operations this week, officials were quick to say, don't worry. I mean, yes, worry about how big and damaging this attack was. Definitely worry about this happening in the future. But don't worry about getting gas for your car.
The target, Colonial Pipeline, which supplies 45% of fuel to the East Coast. Its 5,500-mile network carries gas, diesel, and jet fuel from Texas to New Jersey.
After all, it's not like hackers were able to divert fuel. The company that runs the pipeline, Colonial, shut down the pipeline as a precaution to make sure its software was safe. And so authorities said, look, we will get this taken care of in a few days. Gas will start flowing again, no problem.
I've went to like six different stations and nobody's got any gas.
Everywhere I go, it's bags over the gas pumps.
Tonight, with long lines at the pump and more than 1,000 stations running out of gas, the effects of the Russia-based ransomware attack are being felt up and down the East Coast.
Some airlines are already feeling the effects. American telling us it'll have to make pit stops for fuel on some long-haul flights.
Well, it's been a few days, and judging by the reactions from states along the East Coast, this is a big problem. ABC's chief business and economics correspondent Rebecca Jarvis is with us now. Rebecca, we're now seeing like lines for gas. We're seeing states declaring emergencies. Why? What's going on?
Well, Brad, when you tell a group of people not to worry, essentially the first thing they do is worry. And we are seeing that. And it's very hard to tease out at this time how much of this is truly a supply issue versus a demand issue. And what I mean by that is that the Colonial Pipeline is incredibly important. It is critical to the energy infrastructure of our country. It supplies about 45% of fuel to the East Coast.
Shell 1420, this is Autumn.
And so there are a lot of places along the East Coast that have seen less supply.
We are completely out of diesel and gas. The clerk
at this gas places including Alabama to Louisiana, Tennessee, Georgia, North Carolina, as you just mentioned. So there are issues in specific places with supply getting there as it normally would.
Yeah, I decided it's probably a better idea to gas up now before it goes through the roof.
But there's the additional issue of people racing out to the gas station to fill up because they're worried.
I usually put in like half a tank just to get back and forth to work. But I'm going to go ahead and put in a full tank, and we got our other car up here too. We're going to fill that up too.
And it's real. It is creating shortages.
And now there's nothing here.
Now there's nothing here, yeah.
If you look at the latest numbers from Gas Buddy, they're reporting that 20% of gas stations in Atlanta do not have gasoline right now.
And with increasing demand up 20% in 24 hours, prices now climbing. Tonight, some gas stations setting a limit on just how much gas you can buy.
It's not that we have a gasoline shortage. It's that we have this supply crunch.
The Energy Secretary, Jennifer Granholm, likened this situation to people hoarding toilet paper at the start of the pandemic.
Let me emphasize that much as there was no cause for, say, hoarding toilet paper at the beginning of the pandemic, there should be no cause for hoarding gasoline.
The best advice is if you don't need gasoline, if you're not urgently in need of it, you don't have to sit in that line. There will be gas flowing in the next couple of days.
And it's interesting that you mentioned it's not just even the East Coast and the Southeast because so much of the supply is connected. The other question, Rebecca, is what's next for this pipeline? Like, this cyber attack sounds crippling in that you'd expect Colonial just to open up the pipeline. People are hurting for gas, give them the gas. And yet that has still not happened.
Well, you have, Brad, here the long-term issue, which is how could this happen and how do various pipelines and our infrastructure protect against it happening again in the future? And then you have the nearer-term issue, which is turning things back on. The Colonial Pipeline informed the Department of Energy that by Wednesday afternoon, close of business, they would have a decision about how they could restart. But it's not as simple as flipping an on and off switch.
This pipeline has never been shut down before. It travels great distances. There is fuel in the pipe, and then there is fuel, the offtake from the refineries that have to be added. So it will take a few days to be up and running.
Michael says the Colonial Pipeline has shut down 5 times during his career. That's when the company goes to its backup plan, getting fuel from ports on the East Coast, like Charleston, Wilmington, and Savannah.
We only go down there when we have to because it's so far away, the freight rate is higher, and then that adds to the cost of the fuel that's sold.
And in that time, when one location doesn't have fuel, they have to find it somewhere else. That then puts pressure on the supply elsewhere as well.
Right, and our team actually obtained a Homeland Security bulletin from the DHS, which said 2020 was the worst year for ransomware and cyber attacks in U.S. history. Well, this year, this attack in 2021 might be the most devastating one on critical infrastructure in the U.S. of all time. Rebecca Jarvis, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Okay, we're going to step away once more. When we come back, what happened to Leave No Trace? Mountaintop litter becomes a life or death issue. One Last Thing is next. And one last thing. There are plenty of COVID-19 developments to keep your eyes on today. The CDC will debate whether it should recommend 12 to 15-year-old kids getting vaccinated. In fact, in Georgia, they already are.
I look forward to going to camp this year because last year it got canceled. And so I'm excited to go there and see all my camp friends.
But in other parts of the world, the questions are a lot more dire than, can I get my kid vaccinated on Wednesday or Thursday?
India in crisis. The country's healthcare system pushed to its breaking point.
We are beyond capacity in our ICU. These are lives which could have been saved.
As India's cases and deaths per day continue to shatter records, its next-door neighbor, Nepal, is going through its own surge.
Nepal seeing 57 times more cases now than at this time last month, some blaming travelers coming in from nearby countries.
Just like India, they are in desperate need of oxygen tanks. But there's one part of Nepal where oxygen tanks are used on the regular, Mount Everest. In a country whose economy can rise or fall with one mountain climbing season, Nepal issued more than 700 permits to climb Mount Everest this year. Every person with a permit usually has to bring 3 or 4 big tanks of oxygen with them to use on the mountain, at base camp, everywhere. So this year, Nepal is asking mountaineers to bring their used tanks back down the mountain. You might be thinking, well, duh, like what else would they do with them? Well, often, climbers just leave them up there. underneath layers of avalanche, snow, and rock every year, experts say there are thousands of oxygen cylinders, some of them with air still in them. Nepal says it needs tens of thousands, but every canister would be useful. In the meantime, remember that China has closed off its borders to foreigners because of COVID. Well, Everest is accessible from Nepal in the south, China to the north. So starting this week, China says you're going to see a rope line on the summit so that people entering from Nepal won't be allowed to mingle with people coming from China. Although at that altitude, are people really in the mood to hang out? Imagine someone just summited Everest. This is a mountain that just the universe clearly does not want humans to summit. Like, our lungs were not built to do this. So you think that person, that guy, is going to be scared of the rope line at the top? Good luck with that. Hey, remember, we are always trying to climb the ratings and reviews mountain. So if you have not already, hit us up with 5 stars. Really helps us out. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much I know.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.